the kind of connection to the proper, the authentic, and those sorts of things leads itself to a fascism. I'm wondering what the other commitment lends itself to, right? The sort of non-recognition would be, that's the word that I've always used, the sense of non-recognition or disidentification. Mm-hmm. What does that lend itself towards, right? Because I don't think it's fascism.
The typical fear is laissez-faire, right?
Right, like, that would be the, like, anything, the anything
or
goes.
Like schizo, you know, kind of like just total disidentification to the point of like paranoia and you know, that kind of thing. I mean, Deleuze even writes about that as a possibility, as a potentiality of that situation. But I don't think fascism doesn't arise from that. I think if that's the condition of possibility for life, then fascism would have to be a part of that dynamic as well, right? Or a possibility.
So, but I mean, you'd have to have, I mean, because paranoia strikes me as directly leading to a kind of fascism, right? You know, it's that sense of, like, I'm constantly under threat by the other.
Because you want to collect. Yeah, you want
to. Yeah, like, I have to, so I could see it. But it's, the sense of disidentification or non-recognition is, like, really, don't know, not knowing who you are. As that's the thing that I wrote on Ecce Homo, is, like, that's, become what you are means becoming is what you are, not figure out who you really are and get there. Right.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and ideally, it would lead to some version of empathy, like not in the traditional sense, I guess, but like just in the fact that if you don't know who you are, and if you're allowing for that kind of like real ambiguity into the fabric of your being, then you don't know who anyone else is either.
Yeah, no, but that, like, there's something important, because I know that I've, at least in terms of the field, like, my relationship to the field, like, I know that I've felt that, like, frustration and irritation at, like, not being sufficiently recognized and wanting, and then there is a flip side of me that's, like, there's actually a lot of freedom in the position of not being an important person in the field. Right, like that, I don't have to speak for a position. Like Judith, but like I just to me, she's the paradigmatic case. Like, I can't imagine. This is one of the quotes that the woman said last night, which I thought was great. That Butler said that she attempts to live at some distance from her name, and I thought that was a really interesting way of thinking of the non-recognition thing. That she has to live at a distance from
the institution.
Judith Butler.
Yeah.
Right, like the institution that is myself, you know, at that case, like that level, like whenever you speak, you are always speaking for. Mm-hmm. And my God, like the extraordinary, because I don't even think I'm speaking for myself when I speak, when I write stuff. I don't feel that way, you know, and I have in the past, but I decreasingly feel that way. And there's an extraordinary freedom. Mm-hmm. That's available in not knowing who I am and who I'm supposed to be, or being interpolated into these various subject positions. So,
right, yeah.
I mean, I like to think of that orientation as leading sort of toward a kind of tinkering. You know,
yeah, it
constantly,
can.
Like constantly, you know, playing with what can be made from this or that thing. But you know, like I think it can. You know, it's sort of like thinking about the sort of risks of that orientation. It seems like some kind of alienation through rarefication, you know, is precisely danger there. Is that as you sort of like producing less and less recognizable material that, you know, you can kind of follow the chain of thought, but it's kind of, it's, I mean, you know, this, we find this all the time. It's like fucking hard to talk to, increasingly hard to talk to people about everyday things. You know, when you sort of like follow the rabbit hole down this particular path. And let's keep in mind that fascism has its own modality of rarefication. Like purity is nothing but a rarefication that, you know, refining, perpetual refining to the point. Now that's like a perpetual refining to the point where, you know, nothing exists anymore. And that's its kind of.
But. No. Yeah, I don't know. I just feel like, well, I mean, to go back to the Butler thing real quick, just like she has to literally act as a representative, and this kind of ties into what we're saying. Like, so her
she's
work,
interpolated into the position. It's not like you know,
she didn't really
like,
choose it, but that directly affects the way you think and the way you write. because and you can see it. Her work has become less experimental.
That's right.
Less adventurous, I would say.
And more position taking.
Position taking. It's still pretty. It's still rigorous. It's still very careful. It's still smart, but it's not as promiscuous. Right. To use one of your words.
No, that's good. Right.
It's not as conceptually adventurous, and that's because of the constraints of her position. It's a political position. When you're a representative,
that's right.
You can't write like Zizek.
Right. You know, because of her, the success of her thinking, she can't think anymore.
Right. So yeah, I mean, so in a sense,
that's
like
an exaggeration.
That kind of the thing that allowed her to become what she is has now hamstrung her.
That's right.
Which is very, it's kind of
I just love the locution of that she feels that she has to live at some distance from her name.
That is really, that's good.
Yeah. Yeah. And she chooses they, by the way. That's right. her pronoun.
Yeah. Well, that might be a political decision as well.
I'm certain that it is. Yeah. And in fact, the quote was from her, which pronoun she uses, they, you know, is... they would be the most accurate. And it's for me, it was the word the most accurate that I was like,
huh?
Accuracy? Yeah. That's the question of the pronoun? Like, I didn't think accuracy. But yeah. I understand politically why accuracy. It's like, these words don't fit, this word fits. As opposed to, I'm going to try this word out. Like, it's not a very good political...
right.
It just doesn't have its political efficacy. But I'm not in a position. I'm in a position where I can say that. Like, okay, let's try this pronoun out, mm-hmm. right? Like, and because who the fuck cares, right? Nobody cares what Muckelbauer says about his pronoun or their pronoun. You know what I mean? No one gives a shit.
Yeah.
So there's an advantage to being unimportant.
For sure. And fascism structurally, not politically. There's a fascism too. Like occupying a political position in the sense that you're having to collect all these things under an umbrella that you wouldn't have to otherwise, right? Like you were saying, you're in a relative position of freedom when you write and when you think, because you're not acting as a representative. Right. And when you're in the position that Butler has adopted, there's almost it's a collecting impulse. It's a fascist impulse that kind of organizes the social field regardless of the actual political contingency involved.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, everybody, this is a tired point, but like there's a fascism of progressivism,
right?
You know, and but there is, I mean, there is there's a team based kind of like, you know, tribal thinking that goes on in each of
and
these
she
spheres.
Has to negotiate that however she does. I mean, you know, we don't know her personally, but like but here's the thing, we're all negotiating that in different ways at different levels. I mean, she just has a sort of public eye in ways that we don't, but we're still, I mean, it's the very question that you're negotiating in terms of your relation to Barad is the big picture one, but also you relate those smaller ones of Davis, Boyle, Deleuze, right? Like those those other figures that we're trying to figure out, like, how do I situate myself in relation? And it's like, well, you have to presume you have a self first, and that matters.
Right. What's interesting about Butler currently is that her new book is that like the politics of nonviolence or something. It's like, and it's so Hegelian. And she mentions Hegel once. She's completely abandoned Hegel from her like citational, you know, pool. But the book is so overtly Hegelian. So strategically, she must be thinking Hegel is not relevant for my kind of scholarship. He's not going to sell books. He's not a feminist. There's nothing, you know, really relevant. But the actual philosophy itself, what the book should be called is The Politics of Violence, because all she talks about is violence and the capacity for human violence in the very fabric of relations. So while she's pushing for something else, right, this kind of ethical move, like past violence, all she's saying is that constitutively we are, as a people, inherently violent.
and can't not be.
Life.
Right. Life itself is violent.
But that's okay. Like, I don't, that doesn't, I mean, I've always thought of her as being, I mean, her dissertation was on, like, I've always.
No, I know. No, it's just funny that, like, she's had to kind of move past him, at least from, like, a marketing perspective. I don't know. It's like.
But also sort of a thinking person, like, for instance, in the style book, I don't think I've cited Deleuze once, right? Like, right. It's certainly not intentional. It's just like, yeah. Well, that stuff is just pretty fundamental to how I think. It's not,
That's
it's not something that I'm necessarily talking about, right? So you never know. Yeah.
It could be that. That would be the more generous way.
Right. It's like, this is just the terrain of my thinking. It's not something that you could cite like a quote. It's just how I think. Yeah. So, I mean, I thought that way. I will also say, I thought that way about Nietzsche for a long time. I remember when I first taught the very first class on Nietzsche that I taught, and it felt, because I had not talked about Nietzsche other than the Truth and Lies essay, like, ever. And it was for that exact reason. It's because this thinking just felt so close to me that I didn't want to cite it, because that just seemed like, that's ridiculous. That's so small and puny. Like, this is the terrain or milieu of how I think.
Mm-hmm.
And over the last decade since I did that, I now have a different kind of relationship with Nietzsche, where
that was
I still think...
Ago? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
It was.
You know, I still think that it is the terrain and milieu of my thinking, but I can talk about it in ways now. Like, I'm not there with Deleuze. Deleuze is just such a terrain for my thinking that I can't really talk about it, because it just seems wrong, and I also don't want to. It seems so partitioned to say, like, I'm going to talk about a chunk of Deleuze or something. Like, I don't want to do it. Like, you know, the logic, I wasn't in favor of doing the logic of sense, you know, which is weird, right? Like, I'm supposed to be Deleuze boy.
Okay, so if you wanted to say, you know, there's only difference in identity and they're at war with each other, then that would be to reify. I think that would be to do too much of privileging the side of identity, right? Because, you know, there are only two things, right?
Yeah. Right.
But I think that you could arrive at this, a particular kind of plurality, a particular kind of, like, constant tension through a prior monism of pure movement, of that, you know, there is nothing that is essentially substantial. There's only the making substantial through, you know, force on force interaction. But the provisional making nominal of something is constitutive of movement. And so, like, there is no, it's only, and you know, I
but
don't
you would,
think
but
that.
But hold on a second. You would say that's what movement is the provisional making nominal of something.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Like, that is what movement is.
Yeah.
So that's where, to me, you have, that's a difference. You don't have two forces warring with one another. You have one force, sort of.
That self-differentiates.
That self-differentiates, right? Like, so that to me, it just
but
feels
reactive
very different.
Force, but this is, I've always had, like, literally from the very first reading group I did with you on Nietzsche and philosophy in your old apartment, like, how many ever years ago, I've always had a certain issue with of imagining thinking and consciousness solely in terms of reactive force. And it's like, that's reactive force and everything else is active force. And, like, think about a supposedly non-human encounter of, like, a bird building a nest or a wolf eating a sheep. You know, there is an active-reactive set of relationships there as well. Like, does not the bird nominalize in some ways the nest provisionally? Does not the wolf nominalize or, you know, make an object out of the sheep? And then doesn't the reaction of the sheep, you know, like, I don't know, bleeding or whatever else, a series of reactive forces that sort of continue to concretize a provisional momentary relationship? Like, that doesn't seem to me to be just an act of consciousness or thinking. And frankly,
It doesn't have to be consciousness. It doesn't have to be. That's just the sort of terminological, like, I'm okay with that, but I still would say there, you know, active force confronting active force, right? Because it's never just it's never just one active force, like, but active force produces reactions, like deterritorialization produces reterritorializations,
only one of which we call consciousness.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, I'm fine with that. Consciousness doesn't have to be the uber one. It just tends to, consciousness does, I mean, look, just even how you frame the question, it's like, imagine a wolf doing this, and it's like, okay, well, we've already nominalized these things and then considered them an action.
Right.
And that's fine. Like, that's, I don't have a problem with that. That's okay. But that's just one thing among others. In terms of what's happening, you know, in the scene of that kind, I feel like you can say there's only active force, and there are just the sort of residual reactions of formations called the wolf, called the nest, mm-hmm. called the whatever the things are that we're talking right. about.
Like, nest building right. would be, you know, the constitutive active force that constitutes both the bird and the nest, right? You would have to say.
Yeah, that's right. And that. So, for instance, like, and let me just say, like, even when you do the thing that he does with, you know, the section that we just talked about, the noun and the verbing of the mm-hmm. what participles get you, right, is something interesting about that. Even still, he wants to say for the noun, which is the present, right, that's mm-hmm. the present version, this is, right, even for the noun, we still have to show the verbing or action, mm-hmm. like, that's still the thing that's missing. Like, to me, on 236, this question of presence that you guys were talking about yeah. when I logged on initially, but this rise from unconcealment as the entry into what is unconcealed does not specifically come to the fore in the presence of what is present. It is part of presence to hold back these traits and thus to let come out only that which is present. So presence in that sense, what presence gives you, the nominalize, is it gives you the things there. The tree is there. The mountain is there. All mm-hmm. these things are, right? What it doesn't give you is the coming to fore of the presence, mm-hmm. right? It doesn't give you the entry into unconcealment of the presence. In other words, it doesn't give you the active force or the movement, which is, so in other, that's where I'm saying, like, he wants to hang on to the simultaneity of the noun and the verb, except for the noun is verbed. Right. Yeah, so it's like, yeah. So why hold on to this simultaneity when in fact it seems to me like the direction here is saying go verb, like go to the verb.
Right? Well, or you would, or there's just different speeds of verbs. And, you know, like one way of saying that active reactive right. force, they're not, you know, different kinds of force. They're just, you know, one force is only ever slowing down another force. Right. Right. And then so like a noun is only ever slower moving verb.
Right, that's fine. Right. I'd be super comfortable with that because what one doesn't have there is a Hegelian dialectic.
Yeah.
Right? Like, one doesn't get that then. One gets a kind of monism that residually has Hegel. In other words, it is like, you know, everything that occurs in the Hegelian milieu will be right, but only as an epiphenomena right. of active force.
And right. I think you get that in his critique of the concept is that, you know, like in his critique of the dialectic and his critique of the concept is that, you know, that sort of movement is only possible within a very particular realm. But that realm is, again, this sort of like subspecies or this sort of offshoot of something a little bit more originary.
Right.
Like, you know, this moment of thinking shot off a particular thing that we'll call rational understanding, and Hegel did a really fucking good job of diagnosing the way that that little thread runs, but it's one thread of a bunch of other stuff, and it doesn't, and it's not nearly as inescapable as Hegel imagines it. It's only inescapable if you confine yourself to a human consciousness and human understanding.
Right. And I would agree, and I would agree with that, and I would say, and that would be the importance of Hegel, right? Like, yeah. And that would be an saying, like, look, here's, I mean, that's a way of saying Hegel's not wrong,
yeah,
but he's also not right. You know,
well, he's right in a particular milieu.
Yeah, he's very right about a thread, right? About a machine, but I mean,
which is a really big
fucking machine. Yeah, it's a really big. Yeah. We'll call it, you know, the vast majority of, you know.
I mean, for Hegel, it's the only machine. So that would right. be the difference between him and Deleuze, is that Deleuze is positing
yeah.
a primary vital force or right. a primordial flow of desire or whatever right. part of his right. language you want to use
that makes that is lots beneath of machines.
Primary to, constitutive of subjectivity and representational thinking. But that's just one of its offshoots, right? It can enable yeah. physical life, etc., anything besides the subject. And this Absolutely. Is where I think Derrida, if we pick the right essays or the right combination of essays, he will be an interesting fulcrum on which to think these two kind of modes of thought. Because in a lot of places, he leans towards the Deleuzian orientation, where he's kind of an ontological thinker, right? The trace lends itself that way.
Different. But then
Differance also is equally invested in subjective aporia as it is in like material difference, right? Yeah. So it's like almost like he's playing both sides, or he's attempting to throughout his career, like play the Deleuze and play the Hegel, and like, you know, see the what complexity. Right.
Well, and he certainly got taken up in that sort of subjective aporetic sense primarily first, right?
Right.
That, and one still has to make the argument for, like, you have to, it's not just a given that Derrida is a materialist thinker.
Right, right. Right.
Or even an ontological thinker. Mm-hmm. Like, it's that's not a given.
You that was work that was done. Yeah.
Right, right.
Over the last 20 years, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Or but I guess that's, I mean, in part, I feel like that is coming out of his Heideggerian. Right, like I mean, one of the things that that appeals to me about Deleuze is he sort of starts from a kind of a sense of Nietzschean movement is like,
right.
I mean, I was thinking several minutes ago in the course of our conversation, like we had a great little exchange there, and it's literally not going to be hearable by anyone who hasn't read very specific books, right? Not just like, right, like they're,
right, right.
Like, they're, I mean, it's got to be Phenomenology of Spirit. It's got to be Deleuze's book on Nietzsche. It's got to be The Genealogy of Morals.
Yeah.
It's got to be Heidegger, Was heißt Denken, and Being in Time. Like, no, it's that like 10-minute exchange we had, unless the person has read these five books and like in a particular way.
Yeah.
I was just going to say this episode is for Thomas, but then you
for instance, there's just an incredibly small number of people that I think would follow that at all, like including us, right?
Yeah.
Like, but there's us, there's like, you know, Neilan.
We're not really the Taylor Swift of like philosophy podcasts, you know. We're not common denominator. You know, it's all over the place. Very specific milieus that only we have entered into.
Right, right. Like, we had that whole conversation using Deleuzian terminology without specifically reference that we were using Deleuzian terminology.
Yeah.
And it never, we didn't miss a beat.
Well, thank God Thinking With has already done a season on Hegel and on Deleuze.
They'll be caught up.
We clearly need to do one Nietzsche after, I think Nietzsche has to be after Derrida.
Yeah, for sure.
I was thinking that. I was thinking, like, we actually do need to do Nietzsche.
Well,
because it's so...
It's funny because we've been doing German, French, German, French.
Yeah,
and then if we do Nietzsche after Derrida, we'll go back to German.
There we go.
I didn't even think of that. Right, right. So that is our sameness difference. Yeah. Sameness difference.
Yeah.
But I do, because for me, when he gets to the to auto right at the end, the last, that's what you missed, is the to, or you got right at the beginning of the to auto. Like, that's the place, given what I'm working on right now, obviously, right? The style question is, can you say the same thing in a different way, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that, the question of sameness and difference is absolutely constitutive, right? Like, that is the problem. Mm-hmm. And the resolution that I am constantly bumping up against that I'm not satisfied with is there are forces of sameness and forces of difference, and they are at loggerheads and in constant tension. And again, for me, that's just the Hegelian. I mean, that, like, it's very familiar to me. I understand that there's a basic opposition between these two fundamental forces, you know, and they're in constant tension and transfer, you know, but I don't like that diagram. Like, that's not a diagram that is, I'm comfortable.
This is not going to solve it, but I mean, one way to think of it is that the engine is the same for both ostensibly distinctive forces, right? So difference in identity or difference in sameness, although they are posed in opposition very explicitly in Hegel and in Derrida and whatever, the engine for the production of both separate forces is the same engine. Right. So or it's a simultaneity. Well, again, the simultaneity, right? Like, you can't, if the opposition is constitutive, but difference is produced as its effect, right? Like, you'd have to think a simultaneity to those two.
I get it. Like, even if you say something like the engine is self-differentiation, you're like, well, you already had a self, so I guess that's not really the engine, right? Like, I mean, I get the problem in there. I'm just not comfortable, you know, with that resolution, and that is the resolution that is. I remember I faced that the final chapter of the invention book was
maturity.
Yeah, and it was on, and the way that it's always thought was, the relation between tradition and invention is seen as one that's in tension. And you can understand that makes sense. Like, new stuff versus old stuff.
Right.
And the huge move for me conceptually in thinking through that was the old stuff isn't old, right? Like, yeah. The old stuff is invented too. And so therefore, what has changed in that is there's no tension, right? Or rather, the tension that one sees between those is secondary. Because one has to produce the notion of a tension. Like, right. you have to generate a sense of the tradition that is opposed to innovation in order to get that. Like, that the tradition isn't a given. The tradition requires invention. So for me, in that deconstructive move, you'd say a different sense of invention is the condition of possibility for the very distinction between invention and tradition. And I feel like that's what I'm doing here, is a different sense of difference. Difference as a kind of, I mean, I keep coming back to illocutionary performance. That's always my word for it, is like, right. That's the condition for the distinction between sameness and difference that does enter us into the Hegelian dialectic, and it does play out exactly that way. I mean, I honestly take that to be his. The other news item to point out is that I am teaching a class on Derrida this spring.
Good.
That's it. Like, in fact, the course description is, the title of the class is Derrida, and the course description is, we will read stuff written by Derrida.
Excellent.
So, but currently there are two students enrolled, so I don't know if that'll make. But one of the reasons that I, because I was talking about it with you guys before, but one of the reasons I decided on was the podcast. I was like, okay, so this is an aside, but one of the things that you guys got to do is, let's pick some text in the next few weeks. Let's pick some text that, like, I'm going to teach. We don't have to read them all. But that's going to be coming up sooner rather than later, is all I'm saying. But what I was going to say is, I take that, and that's one of the things that I'm interested to do, is sort of revisit Derrida on Heidegger.
And around
that question, because that's my preliminary takeaway from stuff I read on Heidegger 20 years ago, was he follows the line of thinking completely, except for the notion of the proper.
Right.
That's the whole problem for him with Heidegger, is this insistence on the proper.
But I wouldn't say that he forces connections. I do agree that I wouldn't even say that he plays with them. Is that he allows for a play of the play of relays that are already set out there.
That's right. And that's where the word play is tricky, right?
Right.
You don't want to say that it's just, you know.
It's not in the ludic, really, like Victor Vatanza way.
Right.
Like, I mean, you know, the first page of Plato's Pharmacy, you know, it begins with that kind of like etymological, you know, overview of, yeah, you know, kolaphos, blow to the cheek, knock, slap, right? And which, you know, like, which he also connects to writing. And, you know, and he makes all of these connections, you know, over the course of the essay, but I wouldn't say that he forces any of them. He follows one, and it leads to another, and it leads to another, and it doesn't create, it's not organized around a center, and it's not organized around an originary, but the circulatory system is not, that gets activated here, it's rigorously produced. It is not haphazardly,
right.
Think
agree.
About the etymology of haphazard. Like, there are elements of chance involved, right?
Yeah.
But
I mean,
not
the,
random.
The reason I say force, I mean, it not like in the awkward sense. I mean, I just kind of meant like appropriate. Like, it's an act. It's an act of appropriation explicitly, as opposed to an act of discovery, right? Like, he pitches it that way. Like, it's not like Differance just fell into his lap. He made that concept, you know. And it's a genius concept, and all the little, you know, even the fucking accent and everything, it all has import and value, but it's not like that just sort of appeared.
But Nate, did you not know it is not a concept?
Yeah.
This concept that is not a concept.
I actually feel like that's one of the, that kind of refrain is probably one of the reasons that Derrida is so hated by so many analytical, like, just having to always say, this is neither an idea, this is neither a word nor a concept. It's like, shut
it's
the fuck
condition.
Up. Like, we got it. Right. Yeah. I mean, we get the logic of the thinking, but, like, neither is anything. So why do you have to keep pointing it out, right?
That and the simple phrase, always already.
Yeah. Always already.
Which, again, I get the distinction.
Which
like,
is the name
like
of a philosophy podcast, by the way. Always already. Not a bad name for a pod. Yeah, I happened upon that one recently.
It's no thinking with people.
No.
I listened to Philosophize This on Simone de Beauvoir and Nietzsche. And the guy is smart. Like, I like his take on it, but it's just so incredible. Have either of you listened to it? It's so incredibly moralizing that he's pulling out, like, life lessons. You know,
his version of Deleuze is terrible.
Yeah.
I imagine. I haven't heard it.
It's a little basic. I mean, he can be he tries to be, like, funny, quippy a lot of the time. Yeah. I mean,
it's so forced, though.
Yeah, it's bad. I like the guys that you mentioned the one time. I listened to their stuff quite a bit when I was doing some Nietzsche. What's their...
That Partially Examined Life.
Partially Examined Life. That's a good group of guys.
I like that one.
They were all
in a PhD department together, but they all, I think, dropped. I think only one of them finished, and they all kind of got jobs in different places.
Right.
And part of, you know, what they explained that they didn't like about it was the dogmatism, but they still liked reading this stuff, so they just started, like, they've been doing it for several years now.
Yeah.
And they have, like, pretty good like, they've been doing it for quite some time. And yeah, they'll just pick a text, and they won't stick with it nearly as long as we are.
No, they'll do two or three episodes maybe.
Yeah, like text. Well, like, sometimes it'll be like four if it's a really, you know, hefty thing.
Right.
But
they have a page.
But it is much more exegetical. It is much more like, what's the thing here, and then, you know, oftentimes, like, how do we, you know, how is it critiquable? And I do think that, like, there are moments where they're not just doing that, but that is definitely the impulse.
Right. It's good for, like, if you want something a little better than Philosophize This. Like, they have actually pretty engaging conversations. And I like it just as sort of a refresher on certain thinkers. Because, like, you can forget basic stuff with Foucault and Nietzsche. And just to have, like, them going through the main concepts, I'm like, oh, well, I could just talk about Foucault's power. I, like, forgot that he had that central concept as opposed to all these esoteric ones that I was using.
Talk about the slowness that Heidegger interjects into rhythms of thought, and I thought this was a good instance of that. This is the top of 96. He does not say against something temporal. He does not say against some specific characteristic of time. He says flatly, revulsion against time. Of course, the words and it was follow directly. That means, does it not, against the it was in time? And he's trying to say, like, look, there's one way of reading this wherein the will's revulsion against time isn't against time as such. It's just this one aspect of time, this pastness that it was. Right. And this is where Heidegger's, like, working through, like, it's not just that. This is just straight up time or timing.
Mm-hmm.
Time includes not only the past, but also the future and the present. Nietzsche then, by stressing that it was, does intend time in a particular respect and not time as such in general. But what about time? After all, it is not bundled in with the past, future, and present are wrapped up together. Time is not a cage in which the no longer now and the not yet now and the now are cooped up. How do matters stand with time? This fucking phrase, by the way. How do matters stand with time? They stand thus. Time goes.
Time goes.
Just wrote in the margin. That's another one of my LOL moments. I'm just like, fucking Heidegger. This is such a you move.
Yeah. That's so you, Heidegger.
Yeah. They stand thus. Time goes.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't have relationships with these texts.
Yeah. It's just like, it's and what is the essential nature of an animal? It is a beast.
But I'm just saying, like, that's something that you would say to a loved one. Like, right, it's so you. It's so you to say that.
Fuck you.
That's just Heidegger.
Right.
It's Heidegger being Heidegger again. The passing of time is, of course, a coming, but a coming which goes in passing away. What comes in time comes to stay, but to go. What comes in time always bears beforehand the mark of going past and passing away. This is why everything temporal is regarded simply as what is transitory. This is why that it was does not mention just one out of time's three sectors. Rather, the true endowment which time gives and leaves behind is what has passed away, that it was. Time gives only what it has, and it has only what it is itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a way of, to what I'm getting there is like, he's, and in some ways, this is a demonstration of a lot of what he's been talking about. Like, you have to get yourself, you have to open up the passage to reveal its essential quality. This is a demonstration of kind of what he means by that, is to talk about time and its it was. And, you know, in the next paragraph, maybe I'll read this in a second, he talks about that conjunction there is not just adding something on, but as a way of getting at the, that essential notion of time as a process that instantiates moments of power of passings into moments. Right. And it doesn't matter if that happened in the past or will happen in the future or is it now. It is the operation of the demarcation that, you know, that that will reviles against, and reviles against itself. And this is what I'm just starting to put together right now, is why, you know, at first I had this in the back of my head, like, why in the world would the will be revolted by this? This seems to be its exact operation, right, to demarcate. And it doesn't make sense to say that this is a limit of the demarcating power of the will. It's exactly the power of the will to demarcate, to create moments, right, to create events, to create things, to deploy these metaphysical operations. Except for the fact that, oh shit, now I just lost it. I was on the fucking mountaintop.
And you're almost there.
In a cave, but I'm going to try to talk my way through it.
That's all right.
It's like the will reviles itself, its own mechanism.
Yeah, the will reviles against its own, it reviles against its own capacity to do that.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't want to be an appropriation machine, which it sort of is.
Encountering otherness is encountering something that is not yet will.
Right.
Right. And so that's the sense in which the it was is like, what do I do with this? It's a limit. I've encountered a limit. It's very Hegelian in that regard.
And the notion that there was a you or a part of you that is no longer you, right? That's the ultimate, like, terror of the movement.
It's the
of
passing.
Time.
I mean, that's where, like, it was is not just one of time's three modalities. The passing away is what time is.
Right. Right.
Right. Like, and so it's the passing away, the it wasness. Even though it's not yet happened for the future, it's the it wasness that is the sort of target of the will's revulsion. There.
Right.
So he says, like, right below where you're reading, revenge is the will's revulsion against time, and that means against the passing away and its past. Right. It's the passing away quality of time, the becoming present only as a past sort of frozen artifact.
Right.
That limits. Like, the will loves the future, right? Because anything's available and possible.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah.
But no, that it was would still have to be the future, right? Because
but the
futures
the
are nothing more
version.
But future it was.
But that's the change version. That's the thing. So the will initially, the spirit of revenge version of the will, which is what innervates the will at this stage, because we haven't gotten to the eternal return moment. But the will finds itself limited by the past, because that's just what was.
Right.
What can I do with the past? The past is the past, right? There's no possibilities for will there. There's no demarcation. There's no appropriate. There's nothing I can do. It's just, it's already happened and is past. Mm-hmm. So it's the act of passing away that the will experiences a limitation for itself.
Right. Yeah.
See, I was reading that differently, and I just feel like I'm so out of sync with what I was thinking before, but I can at least throw this part out there. Is that it doesn't, I wasn't taking this that the will reviles becoming or the passing away, because that would animate, I mean, that spirit of revenge, like revulsion and revenge are different, right? So it exercises revenge on the passing away, on the pure movement of time, of becoming. But then it is simultaneously revolted by its own operation of timing, of making
creating moments of presence and nowness. Right, like that's what the wheel does, is it creates presence.
And it reviles against that as well.
Yeah.
But it can't do but it can't do that with the past. It can't do that with things that are past, that have passed away. Right? This phase of the thinking. It can't do that. The past is just the past. What can I do with the past? It has happened. Right? I can't exercise my operation of delimiting, controlling, freezing. Right. It's been frozen.
Just to say it like that would be to differentiate the past from the present in a way that I think Heidegger is really trying to prevent, where what is reviled against is time, and time is only that it was.
Passing away. It's passing.
Right. Time is only the passing away. I mean, we try to think in terms of the now. I mean, what he ends up doing is say, like, what's the past? The past is a bunch of nows that you can't do anything with. Right, like, I mean, so the past is a now that's frozen. It doesn't get to make it.
I'm seeing an important difference between passing away and it was. The it was is a part of time that has been carved out. There's no demarcation to it. It's just the perpetual passing away. So what, you know, time is beyond us. We just say time and becoming are the same thing in the sense.
Right.
And the will takes revenge upon by demarcating moments of it. And those moments are the it was. And it frankly doesn't matter if those it wases are in what we would call the past, are in what we would call the now, or what we would call the future. Does that make sense?
So it's the action of, or the active action of making something present that matters. And what happens when you make something present is it becomes the past, does. And then there's a revulsion then to it having become the past, which is the passing away is it's both the condition for the will's action and the thing that it can't stand.
Right.
So even when I encapsulate a bit of what we would commonplace call the future,
I don't feel good about it.
It immediately becomes a past, and then I can't do anything with it.
And I can't do anything with it anymore.
And that's why I revolve.
So it's in a sense it is, that's why it's internal to the will. It's the will's internal problem with itself.
Yeah.
It wants to make presences, but it can't do anything with presences that are already past. It made them into presences.
Right.
Which, in other words, is just another way of saying it can't, like, if the will is pure in the way it only wants to do the same thing over and over and over and over and over again, it can't do what it can't exert that will on what it's already willed.
That's right. Exactly. Right.
Which is why it's a revulsion with itself. It's disgusted by what it's already pooped out.